Yes, 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 my friends, you've come to the right place. It is Truth to Power here on Forward Radio, your community radio station. My name is Justin Mogg, hosting the program today. I'm one of the volunteers here at Forward Radio, and I'm excited to bring you an important conversation about gender in America and legislating gender. That was the subject of the 2024 Minx Auerbach Lecture in Women's and Gender Studies at the University of Louisville. Back on March 7th, there was a wonderful guest speaker that we had in town to talk about this issue named Paisley Kura, professor of women's and gender studies and political science at the City University of New York and author of Sex Is As Sex Does, Governing Transgender Identity. You know, the legislative assault on transgender people here in the United States may seem new, but governments have been regulating the lives of transgender people for decades. Outside of trans communities, few were aware of the Kafkaesque web of regulations that trans people find themselves in today. Now that policing the gender binary has been transformed from an unremarkable aspect of bureaucratic policymaking to a weapon in the culture wars, everyone is starting to pay attention. Now, in this talk that we're going to hear today, Paisley Kura explores the connections between contemporary conflicts over trans issues and the history and persistence of gender and racial hierarchies in American society. And it concludes with an important discussion among the attendees there at the University of Louisville on March 7th. So with no further ado, let's take you there to the planetarium at U of L for the 2024 Minx Auerbach Lecture in Women's and Gender Studies on Legislating Gender with Paisley Kura here on Truth to Power.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. Jan passed me the list of previous Minx Auerbach Lecture speakers. And I'm glad I didn't see that before because it's a very intimidating list of people. So I'm really in very good company. It's a moment to come down here from New York City, to come to Kentucky with all that is going on in the Kentucky legislatures and other legislatures in the South, to talk about the anti-trans legislation and how that relates to women's rights. But one thing I don't want to do, there's this meme that's going around the internet, you know, that book, Oh, the Places You'll Go or The Places I'll Go. So there's this meme, Oh, the Places I'm Allowed to Go. It's cute, you know, it's always fun to kind of invoke Dr. Seuss. But one of the things I'm not going to talk about tonight, but I want to kind of underline, is like this idea that there's a red states and blue states, and red states are bad places and blue states are good places. That is like belied by how the kind of lives people live and the kind of the communities they create and the kind of work they do. So when I'm talking about the anti-trans legislation, it's because it's interesting. There's lots of stuff going on. The book I wrote a couple years ago is really more about just sort of blue state, regular, normal politics. The book I'm working on now does focus on this anti-trans legislation, but I don't want to kind of reproduce the idea of good states and bad states. And even the blue and red distinction is really kind of overdone and doesn't really reflect, you know, the differences of opinion and differences of ways of doing politics that we see. So I am not going to read too much. I'm going to talk so it's more fun for you. I'm not the most coherent person, though, so hopefully I'll make up an enthusiasm what I might lose in coherence. So I'm going to start by talking about a film that came out a couple of years ago. It was released the first day of LGBTQ Pride Month in 2022. It was released by The Daily Wire. It's 95 minutes long, and it features this fellow, Matt Walsh, who's a conservative political talk show sort of person. And the video was called What is a Woman? And within the first year of its release, it had, it's kind of mind-boggling, it had 170 million views on social media. Now they've put it behind a paywall, but that 170 million people watched it. And what the video is about is it's kind of Matt Walsh going around just talking to people, talking to regular people, and asking them what a woman is. And here he's talking to college students. So he talks to women's and gender studies scholars, healthcare professionals who work with trans people, people on the street. He talks to conservative thought leaders. And in the film, he spends a lot of time talking to gender studies academics who I don't think they understand what the film was going to be about. So they kind of were just talking to him in good faith. They don't understand the audience for this film. And they're kind of giving these interesting, to women's studies students, but complicated theories of gender. Like, well, gender is really a socially construction of sex, and Judith Butler said in 1993 that sexual will turn out to have been gender all along. Like, you know, for people who look at the kind of gender studies and gender theory, it's like, yeah, that's a reasonable answer. But to lay people, it just sounds a little crazy. So the conceit of the documentary, of course, is that it's a ludicrous question to ask. It's ludicrous to ask, what is a woman? And well, it's all kind of scripted, but the last scene is Walsh turning to his wife in their kitchen and saying, honey, what is a woman? And she says, well, the answer is easy. A woman is an adult human female. And then she says, honey, can you open this jar of peanut butter? I'm too weak to open it. And he opens it and then hands it back to her, and that's the end of the film. So it's kind of very artfully done. But the whole point is that you don't need to be having a lot of pointy-headed, eggy, intellectual conversations to talk about what sex is. It's really just a very clear answer. It's kind of self-evident, or the battle over transgender rights sometimes seems to turn on these definitional battles, like what is sex, what is gender, what is a woman. I have this slide here. I just grabbed a couple of things. The slide on the left is just a typical kind of education document from some sociology website about sex and gender. The slide on the right, just referring to the Pope just a couple of days ago, talking about like sex difference and the danger of gender ideology. So a lot of the debate right now kind of seems to hinge on these battles over meaning. And the idea is that arguments for the equality of transgender people rely on kind of complicated explanations about gender, about its mutability, about sex as sort of a secondary status, about the importance of gender identity, and the non-binary nature of sex and gender per se. And then arguments against transgender equality usually assert the primacy of biological sex. Like, there's this one thing, it's biological sex. Sex difference is perfectly opposite. There's no complications. It's given by God or nature, and it's unchangeable. So the debate often seems to center around, you know, these battles like, what is sex? What is gender? And through the anti-trans bills that have been introduced in the last few years, this understanding of sex as like either a binary either or property that is dictated by one's sex at birth, it kind of flows through all of them. I'm not going to talk about all the anti-legislation, but one interesting crop of the anti-transgender legislation. There's a couple of bills floating around about pronoun use in the federal, in the U.S. Congress. Senator Cruz introduced a bill blocking the federal government or any of its contractors from requiring them to use the correct, you know, they can't be forced to use the correct pronoun for anybody, or they can't be forced to use the correct name. There's another bill called the Productivity Over Pronouns Act that is also a federal bill, and that is like especially shocking. They basically, whoever wrote this bill, went to some kind of website which talked about gender neutral language and just copied all this language, which looks perfectly fine. So the language is like, you know, gender neutral language and how to be inclusive, and when you use gender-neutral language, you should, you know, use language that avoids bias towards a particular sex or gender. You should avoid using words or expressions or assumptions that would stereotype, demean, or exclude people. It was just kind of a list of how to use gender-neutral language. So they copied this list, they put in this bill, and they said any federal agency or contractor that says people have to use gender-neutral language can't do that anymore. So it's just really... And it's organized around like, because it's not reflecting reality. It's not what sex really is. So, let me get my papers right here. So tonight I want to kind of make three. I think I didn't go to the slide. There we go. Productivity Over Pronouns Act. You can look it up. And tonight I want to kind of make three main points. The first is that transgender equality and the progress that a lot of transgender rights that have been made, a lot of that is an unexpected or accidental byproduct of second wave feminism. So that's the first point. I'll come back to that. The second point I want to make is that the attack on transgender people is definitely the current attack, the current anti-trans legislation. It's definitely intended to harm transgender people, but it's also doing something else. And in that way, it's a bit of a decoy. Another larger agenda is to roll back women's equality, like cisgender women's equality. So some of these anti-trans laws that I'm going to talk about are even called women's bills of rights, and they're purportedly about protecting women. But in fact, these bills and other anti-trans legislation that seem to have nothing to do with cisgender women are actually part of this larger strategy of unraveling the principle that women should be equal before the law. And the third and final point I want to make is that the fight over who is a woman, over the meanings of male and female, is in some way not where the fight really is. If we look at what anti-trans policymakers are actually doing with gender policy, not necessarily the trans legislation, but everywhere, it's clear, and if we compare what they're doing with gender as a policy tool compared to what they say they're doing with gender, we see there's some real distinctions emerge. So I want to pay attention to what they're doing about gender rather than what they're saying it is. Okay, so I'm going to turn to the first point, which is that trans people were accidental beneficiaries of the women's rights movement. And it's kind of, when I make this point in some contexts, people are like annoyed and visibly like, ugh, because trans stuff in some contexts is like, in some queer left contexts is like hip and cool, and second wave feminism is not hip and cool. You know, the kind of stuff that, you know, Minx Arbach was doing here in terms of making, you know, women equal before the law. So joining those two together is kind of a bummer for some young people, but I'm gonna join them together anyways. So the usual story for trans rights activists is that transgender people are part of a group, and trans rights represents like an identity politics where a particular group that has suffered discrimination comes forward, is recognized, and fights for equality. And this was captured in a really clear way in 2016, before the anti-trans stuff really got off the ground, by the Attorney General of the United States at that time, Loretta Lynch. So she announced a lawsuit that was challenging North Carolina's bathroom law, regulating who went to what bathroom. She gave this speech that was really important to a lot of trans people. She said, the lawsuit is about the founding goals and ideals that have led this country, haltingly but inexorably, in the direction of fairness, inclusion, and equality for all Americans. So Lynch situated the rights of trans people within this kind of longer civil rights tradition. Of course, the original civil rights tradition is like the African-American black civil rights tradition. And then she continues. She says, this is not the first time that we've seen discriminatory responses to historic moments of progress for our nation. We saw it in the Jim Crow laws that followed the Emancipation Proclamation. We saw it in fierce and widespread resistance to Brown versus Board of Education. And we saw it in the proliferation of state bans on same-sex unions intended to stifle any hope that gay and lesbian Americans might one day be afforded the right to marry. It is wrong to discriminate against our fellow Americans for something they cannot control. So this country was founded on a promise of equal rights for all, and we've managed to move closer to that promise one day at a time. So this is a perfect example of how transgender rights are part of this kind of civil rights movement moving forward like an identity group defined by some immutable characteristic. Oops, I should be putting my hand over my mic. In the tradition of civil rights. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think there's definitely some truth to the kind of that made transgender intelligible to the media and put the kind of the groups on the social map or on the political map. But I think that there are other huge historical shifts that made what we now would call transgender equality possible. And the one I want to talk about tonight is about liberal feminism. And by liberal feminism, I simply mean the kind of feminism that suggests men and women should be equal before the law, and the state shouldn't treat men and women differently, or give more stuff to men than to women. So like the denial of vote, or barring women from holding office, or serving in the professions, or partaking of educational activities, that's just that kind of really old-fashioned liberal feminism. So what I want to kind of suggest, and then I'll give you an example to kind of exemplify this, is that transgender people, when transgender people started coming forward and saying, hey, the law doesn't really fit me, I need to change my birth certificate, or I need you to recognize me, a lot of times transgender people were denied. And some people think, you say, oh, that was transphobic. That was like mean to transgender people. But what I want to suggest is that those exclusions were like accidental. The law hadn't accounted for transgender people. But transgender people weren't specifically or intentionally targeted. So in social science, there's this kind of concept called a residual category. So it's what's left over, or kind of an unanticipated remainder that's left over after the classification is built. So the sex classification system in the law, like there are men and women, when it was built, didn't anticipate transgender people. So trans people come along and they're just, there's no kind of no fit for them. So I'm going to provide a concrete example. So, I'm a little one step behind on the slides. That's my identity politics picture. It's just, you know, I just grabbed it. And that's my liberal feminism picture. So I kind of like that one. It's sort of, this is like everybody's great-great-grandmother. In 1965, a woman named Anonymous petitioned the New York City to change her birth certificate. She had been assigned male at birth, and she was now female, and she wanted to have a birth certificate that said that. So she petitioned the New York City Commissioner of Health, this is a picture of him, George James, to change her birth certificate. And in fact, the New York City Board of Health had already given trans women a few birth certificates. Like four or five people had come along and they're like, what is this? But okay. And then by the time Anonymous came along, that's how she's known in the court records, the Commissioner of Health was like, wait a sec, there's like a little too many people here. We need to kind of stop and think and get a policy about this. So one of the things he did is he convened a committee. He convened a committee of expert doctors. This is in the 60s. To kind of advise the city on what their policy should be when transsexual people, in the language of the day, wanted a new birth certificate. So the committee met, and you can look at their minutes. They met a few times. And the discussions are super interesting because they're all doctors. Every single person on the committee is a doctor. And they spent a little bit of time talking about chromosomes and genitalia, but 80% of the discussions they had were about the social and legal ramifications of what would happen if they allowed people to change, if they allowed this woman and other trans people in the future to change their sex classification. And they really, they kept saying, like, what are the ramifications of us allowing people to do this? And then they went so far as to, write away to the federal government, they wrote away to an official of the Department of Health and Human Services and say, hey, like, what should we do? So the official was tasked with responding. He writes this, you know, it's all very sweet. There's all these like courier typed things in the files and someone typed this out. He said, wow, that's a really interesting question. The problem sort of is that agencies, in carrying out their work, but in certain agencies, benefits to women differ from benefits to men. So you're gonna have to figure that out. So they're kind of suggesting like this trans person is kind of upset this system of benefits. So this New York City committee concluded that like this transsexual person, Anonymous, couldn't change her birth certificate and no one should be able to. And they also talked about marriage. They say if we let her change her birth certificate, I don't think they use her pronouns, but if they let this person change her birth certificate, and then if she married a cisgender man, and they definitely didn't use the phrase cisgender man, but if she married a cisgender man, she could be committing a fraud against the public. So even if a cisgender man happened to know, but there'd be like kind of a fraud because marriage is limited to one man, and one woman. So this is a really kind of clear example to show that sex classification policy is never just about this thing we call sex, but it's about the concerns, but it actually concerns the use of these classifications to further other government ends. So like benefits is built into it. So the title of the book is that I just finished was called Sex Is as Sex Does. It's like the definition is sort of reverse engineered towards a particular agency's role. So by asking to change their legal sex classification, trans people were inadvertently undermining the key part of a centuries-old state apparatus that would ensure the subordination of women. So if you want to treat men and women differently, you got to be able to know who's a man and who's a woman. So that's why sex is baked into the legal architecture. So sex classification, understood as binary, as a binary of male or female, had long been cemented into this, into these laws and policies that use sex to ensure the denial of rights and resources to women. Okay, so that's an example of how like transgender kind of people kind of ran into this edifice of sex discrimination. But over the course of the 20th century, of course, sex was sort of decommissioned or disestablished from government. Like over the course of the 20th century, but especially speeding up in the 1970s and 80s, the idea that the government shouldn't treat men and women differently became to be more and more accepted. And then we see a lot of the speed up in the 1970s and 80s with, you know, when Justice Ginsburg was at the American Civil Liberties Union, and then later when she was on the Supreme Court, when he was actually running the decisions. And the kind of the culmination, I think, of the decommissioning of sex was probably the 2015 decision that said, Supreme Court's decision that said bans on same-sex marriage are unconstitutional. So people understand this decision, this Obergefell decision, as a gay rights case, and it was. But the what made the ban on same-sex marriage work was the very existence of sex classifications in the law. So you can't say a man can't marry a man unless you know who a man is. So when with Obergefell, came down, that really changed, that was kind of the last, one of the last kind of straws of legal sex discrimination, and that changed the landscape for a lot of transgender policy. There's one place where you really see where men and women treated differently, and that's in selective service. So anybody assigned male at birth has to register, and people assigned female at birth do not. There's you know, almost a bipartisan agreement that that's not necessary anymore, but no one wants to talk about it. No one wants to remind voters that selective service exists. They hope the 18-year-olds go and sign up and forget about it really quickly. So it's politically, it's not something that anybody thinks is a good idea to touch. So the point of the idea the first point I want to make then is that saying no to trans people's sex reclassification petitions hadn't necessarily been a result of what we now call transphobia. It was that allowing people to change their sex classification will call into question this key instrument for maintaining gender hierarchies between cisgender men and women in state policy. So we had Obergefell in 2015, but in New York City, which wouldn't change people's birth certificates, New York State got rid of its ban on same-sex marriage in 2011. And so New York City, after 2011, New York City was like, oh, let's change our birth certificate policy. So this is kind of a picture of the mayor at the time, Mayor de Blasio, with a bunch of trans people at a signing ceremony for a bill that would make it possible for it to be very easy to change your birth certificate. And I always like to point out, Phyllis, I shouldn't turn around, but the person on the far right is Victoria Cruz, and she's one of the original Stonewall veterans, and she actually is alumna of the college I teach at Brooklyn College. Okay, so now I want to turn to the current moment about what's going on now. There's so many different maps of all the stuff that's going on now, but we are in this moment of growing backlash. 23 states now ban trans girls and women from playing women's sports. 22 states, including Kentucky, limit or restrict medical care for youth. There's a lot of maps. If you're ever interested, there's this organization called the Movement Advancement Project, and they have all the maps of all the different policies around LGBT issues. If you're interested in legislation, there's this group called the Trans Legislation Tracker, like translegislation.com, and they're pretty good at keeping up with the bills, but they're not perfect because you can't keep up with the bills because they're coming out like five a day, but it's a pretty good start to your research. So in a growing number of red states, in growing number of states, laws now govern gender classification in bathrooms, and two states, Idaho and Florida, make it a criminal offense for someone to use a bathroom inconsistent with the sex assigned at birth. There's bills governing pronoun use in schools, the conditions under which queer and trans-related books and curriculum can be are permitted. And none of these issues would have registered in the public consciousness even a few years ago. There's this clip of Donald Trump from June of 2023 talking about this. You know, whatever you think of Trump, he's sort of like he's got like a political gene. Like he's sort of an astute political observer, and he has this clip. He's saying, he says like, you know, I talk about taxes, you go like this. I talk about transgender stuff, and you all go crazy. And 5 years ago, you didn't even know what the word meant. You didn't even care. But now people do care. So you know, Trump is paying attention. And that's so the bills I just talked about. That's just the bills that have been passed. That doesn't even get to the. At last count, 513 bills introduced recently in Congress and the state legislatures. So where Republicans were busy enacting laws targeting multiple aspects of trans life, 21 states under Democratic control changed policy to allow people to choose an X on their driver's license. And that for me is like a sort of a proxy for whether the state's policy overall on gender identity. So instead of saying you can't change your driver's license at all, states like New York and California and a bunch of others allow people to change their sex classification to MF or X for non-binary or X for opting out just by filling out a form. In the wake of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization and the trans care bans, 11 states have passed refuge or shield laws for medical professionals, which often combine protections for reproductive and gender affirming care. Forgive the order. So, and that turns out to be important. In November, a few months ago, the Texas Attorney General sent a letter, or something more formal than a letter, some sort of legal document to a hospital in Seattle, Washington, to turn over the names of all the patients from Texas who were under 18 who had traveled from Texas to Washington to get some sort of gender-affirming care. He's like, I want to know the names, and I want to know what treatment they got, and the idea being he would pursue them and their parents and so on. And of course, anticipating this, Washington had passed a shield law, so they're like, no, we're not responding. But you can really see there's like a battle brewing. But the kind of bill I want to talk about in specific detail tonight are these bills that define sex. So one weird artifact of law and policy is that sex and gender are often defined differently at different agencies. Like the DMV might have a different definition of sex than a homeless shelter, et cetera. And so what these defining sex acts is they say, this is the definition of sex, and it applies all throughout the state law, all throughout the state code. They're often called women's bills of rights. And there's been a handful that have passed. I guess 1, 2, 3, 4, there's like 6 that have passed. The dark orange, I think, is executive orders. One has been introduced in Kentucky, and the intent of this bill is to say we need to protect women, and we need to ensure that women have safety and privacy, and that men can't come into their spaces. So they cover the use of sex segregated facilities, which is not good for transgender people. So like in Florida, like what bathroom am I supposed to use? If I go into a men's bathroom, technically I am a criminal. If I go into a women's bathroom, that's gonna make women uncomfortable. So they kind of create this kind of impossible situation for transgender people. The other thing they do though, is they say any state agency that collects vital statistics needs to define sex according to sex, you know, as defined at birth. And I don't know if I can find the piece of paper, but they usually define sex in terms of like females have the capacity to develop ova and males have the capacity to develop sperm that will fertilize the ova. Some of them are kind of funny because they'll say females have ova and males have sperm that will fertilize the ova of a female. There's just a lot of extra words and language that kind of floats around. But what that means actually for transgender people, it kind of produces this kind of legal erasure because all the documents are going to be now, you're going to have your birth sex on them. So in Kansas, this is where it's kind of happening the quickest. They passed a women's Bill of Rights in 2023, and the Attorney General of Kansas interpreted that to say, okay, anybody who wants to get a birth certificate, a driver's license, it's going to be your birth sex. So after the bill passed, but before it became law, there's usually a space in between the passage and its effective date. A whole bunch of people rushed to change their driver's license and identity documents because they hadn't got around to it. They're trans people. They're like, oh, that's a document I definitely need to change. But unfortunately, the Attorney General, he interprets the law as applying retroactively. So basically, any person who has changed the sex classification of their document, the next time they apply, you know, you get your license in the mail as a renewal, they're going to get their birth sex back on it. So it creates a real problem for transgender people. There's a Defining Sex Act.
Just breaking in to remind you that you're listening to Truth to Power here on Forward Radio, and we are listening back to the March 7th Minx Auerbach Lecture in Women's and Gender Studies at the University of Louisville, featuring Paisley Kura, professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Political Science at the City University of New York, and author of Sex Is, Sex Does, Governing Transgender Identity. And we take you back there to March 7th now here on Truth to Power.
This is a quote I really like. Creates a problem for transgender people because identity documents are just vital to so many day-to-day interactions in terms of people handing over identity, getting on the plane, applying for loans, applying for everything. Identity documents are a real problem. And as this trans woman described it, over 20 years ago, she goes, "I don't suffer from gender dysphoria. I suffer from bureaucratic dysphoria. My ID does not match my appearance. Every time I apply for a job, every time I authorize a credit card check, every time I buy a plane ticket." So these defining sex acts are going to have devastating effects on transgender people. I mean, they're being challenged in the courts, which is good, but the courts are not, who knows what they'll do. I mean, the courts, there's in federal courts, many, the Republicans had success. The Republicans had a lot of success placing, Republican jurists in those positions. Okay, so that's like, these are bad for transgender people. Now I want to talk a little bit about actually how they're bad for women per se. So I think in some sense, these laws are like, have a dual purpose. They are to harm transgender people and get people upset and kind of stir up the culture wars. But it's also a decoy of a larger project. And I was, in doing this reading, which is part of new work, and it's not all totally worked out, I was thinking, am I being paranoid? And then I was thinking about all the work that the right wing did, laying the legal foundations for overturning Roe for, 30, 40 years, like a paragraph here, a paragraph there, a decision. And so I think it's at this moment in our history, it's not too paranoid to look at like weird little things that are happening in these laws, and I'll talk about a few of them. So, as I said before, very often the rationale for these bills, which is made clear in the rhetoric when they're announced and in the legislative history, is to protect women from harm. But if you look at what this legislation does, rather than what it says it does, a different picture emerges. Many of these sex definition bills refer directly or indirectly to the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which says, "No state shall deny to any person the equal protection of the laws." Over the course of the 20th century, he doesn't mention sex, but over the course of the 20th century, but especially starting in the 1970s and continuing through the 1980s, courts began to understand the Equal Protection Clause to apply to gender-based discrimination. And so the idea that governments could treat men and women differently was understood to violate the Equal Protection Clause. I mean, one of the most famous cases involved VMI, Virginia Military Institute. By that time, Justice Ginsburg was on the court and wrote the opinion. So this is just a bit, teeny bit in the weeds, but not too much, a little bit, I hope. So in all this kind of equal protection jurisprudence, there's this kind of concept called intermediate scrutiny. And what it says is, and this comes from the Supreme Court and other courts, what it says is a law that discriminates on the basis of sex or gender, and they would use different words, but they're interchangeable in legal discourse in the Supreme Court. A law that discriminates on the basis of sex or gender will be found to be unconstitutional unless the law furthers an important government objective by means that are substantially related to that interest. So there's got to be a very good reason for a law to treat men and women differently. So many laws that treated men and women differently were struck down. And, you know, you can, if you, you can look at the work of Justice Ginsburg in the 70s when she was an advocate. Her particular strategy was to find laws that harm men, because she thought the men, the judges would identify with the men victims of sex discrimination. So she'd find, like, a dependent of a military officer who was a man who didn't get the same benefits as a dependent of a military officer who was a woman. So she would find cases where the judges would identify with the man, and it was successful. Anyway, so most of these laws were struck down, but they did leave an important kind of principle in place, was like, there still can be laws that treat men and women differently as long as there's an important government objective. And the idea, as Ginsburg and others wrote about, is like, the important government objective could be to help women to redress past problems. So like programs that especially help women, if they were narrowly tailored to do that, that could be permissible even under, you know, what the lawyers call intermediate scrutiny. And here's what's, I think, interesting and what's happening. At these sex declaration, these women's bills of rights, these sex definition laws, most of them have a paragraph referring directly or indirectly to that. They're saying, oh, we still believe in intermediate scrutiny and government, important government objectives. But there's a shift happening in what counts as an important government objective. So sex segregated institutions, privacy, that's an important government objective, to be sure. But there's this new government objective, it seems, which is just to legislate gender. So to be clear, instead of serving some important governmental objective of helping women, the important government objective has become defining women. And the important government objective, the important government interest, becomes maintaining the distinction between men and women. So it's almost kind of a tautology. And it's not just about defining women as biological, that's harmful to trans people. There's also this kind of connection that gets asserted between biology and social norms that that create laws that affect men and women differently. So, sorry. And I'll give you some examples so you can maybe see what's happening. And this trend in equal protection laws and in the discourse is beginning, could possibly reverse the trajectory of equal protection laws. So where the state could treat people differently. I'm missing any slides. This is Justice Scalia before he died in 2000. This is him from 2011. And he's basically saying, yeah, the Constitution does not prohibit discrimination based on gender. So he's saying, by the way, the Equal Protection Clause, that doesn't have got anything to do with gender. You can pass a law that says no sex discrimination, but it's not in the Constitution. And that was an outlying position. That was like kind of wacky. You look up the discourse around at the time, people are like, oh, what a guy. But realizing how the Dobbs decision kind of unfolded over the years, was it might not be so wacky in terms of what's going on. But I just want to give you one example of like how these laws and policies that seem to be just about biological sex are part of rolling back gender-based equality per se. Here's an example from 2023 in Texas. The Texas Department of Agriculture, they issue a memo announcing to employees that they must dress in clothes consistent with their biological gender. So it's kind of meant to be sort of like everything in Texas, like just kind of like trolling trans people, like an anti-trans memo, right? You have to dress consistent with your biological gender as established by birth. But if you think about it, it also reinscribes not just gender difference, but gender norms per se. So under this policy, trans masculine people have to wear clothes traditionally coded as female. But so too does cisgender people, cisgender women. So you can see how like trans women, the attacks on trans people, but cisgender people cisgender women are especially going to be rolled into it. And one of the things that's interesting about this is a lot of this anti-trans case law, they love to quote Justice Ginsburg, because in the VMI case, she says, sure, there are enduring differences between men and women. There are enduring physical differences. So in all the anti-trans case law, they love to quote Ginsburg because they're a feminist against the trans plaintiffs. She was referring to physical differences, but Ginsburg also wrote about what she called self-fulfilling prophecies. And I love this kind of phrase. It's so refreshingly simple, because we talk about the constitutive nature of gender and blah, 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 blah. We have this highly theoretical language to describe like gender norms are effects of power. And Ginsburg uses the phrase self-fulfilling prophecy. And what she meant was a government or a state couldn't say women are not good engineers, so they don't need to go to engineering school, right? So if you say women can't be engineers, then denying them entrance to engineering school, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Or when I teach Intro to Women's Studies, I love the example of the Boston Marathon that didn't allow women to compete. And you can see pictures of it online. And so this woman runs it. She somehow gets in it and she runs it. And the marathon officials, they see her there and they see her running and they rush to pull her out. But if women can't run a marathon, you don't need to go pull her out, right? She'll just fall and cry or do whatever, like a weak woman will do. And we know now that women can certainly run marathons and finish marathons. But it's the example of the self-fulfilling prophecy of some of these laws. So legislating gender in this way does the work of tying anti-trans initiatives in this larger rollback of equality discourse. And it actually kind of gets worse, because in the anti-trans legislation, there's some stuff happening that transgender advocates and transgender rights lawyers are paying a lot of attention to, but women's rights lawyers are like, oh, whatever, that's just the transgender stuff. They're like supportive of their allies, but they don't really care. But there's some cases, including the Sixth Circuit case that included a challenge to Kentucky's ban on gender-affirming care for youth. There's some cases that say some kind of scary stuff. So in that case, that denying gender-affirming care to trans youth, lawyers had said, oh, you know, that's sex discrimination when you deny gender-affirming care to trans youth. So, for example, you can give gender-affirming care to a cisgender teenager because they don't feel male enough or female enough. But if you give cisgender gender-affirming care, like hormones or something, to a trans teenager, the law doesn't allow that. So advocates will point out, like, that's an example of sex discrimination. Reading these cases is kind of horrifying because there's all these paragraphs. There's one paragraph they say, and by the way, the Equal Protection Clause doesn't refer to women. Title VII does, so that's fine, but we don't really think the Equal Protection Clause applies to gender. And like, that's a huge deal to throw that, just drop it into this anti-trans decision that people aren't really paying attention to. So it's you can see how this rollback of transgender rights is also related to the attack on women's rights. And another example would be just the kind of logic of sex discrimination. So for a long time, the states would say, and the Supreme Court would agree, as long as you treat men and women equally, laws that discriminate based on sex are fine. So the really typical example was the ban on same-sex marriage. Like, men can't marry men, but women can't marry women. So they both can't do what they want. So that's equal. And so over time, the justices at Obergefell were like, yeah, that doesn't seem so equal, because it actually operates to kind of harm gay people. But now in these decisions, we see that's coming back. Like, as long as men and women are similarly, like, you deny gender-affirming care to a trans boy and you deny gender-affirming care to a trans girl, that's not sex discrimination. So everybody, of course, everybody who does this litigation thinks it's sex discrimination, but they're starting to kind of drop these paragraphs and start to see these cases with arguments that will harm women's equality as well as transgender people equality. The third part of my argument, which gets to the conclusion, was that all these fights about who's a woman and who's a male and what's sex and what's gender, they're important to pay attention to, and it's important to kind of think about what's going on. But we also need to pay attention to, like, policy decisions that are made in other arenas, because then we can, and maybe that will kind of help us understand, like, larger shifts that are happening. So I've been talking all about these legal categories, which is fun to talk about. It's because it's like, you can criticize the judge can criticize you. Like, it's almost kind of this kind of hermeneutically closed circle of logic and craziness, and everybody can yell at each other. But it's very antiseptic. It's these legal categories are like deracinated. They don't really describe the real world. And that's why the law is such a powerful tool in replicating inequality, because it seems everybody's just sort of, abstracted from the messiness of the real life. And so I want to turn back kind of to the messiness of the real life and show that other things are going on. So over and over again, these folks say men and women are not fungible. This comes up over and over again, fungible. I saw it in a whole bunch of things. I was saying to my kid, my 14-year-old, I was like, I just saw fungible three different times, including in Ginsburg. And like, academics, you get excited when you see a certain kind of like similar use of language. And she was like, that is the most boring thing I've ever heard. But over and over again, they say men and women are not fungible. Men and women are not fungible. And that's because along with the ideology of biological sex difference comes this idea of gender complementarity. That like men and women do different things. Men go out and earn money, fight wars. Women stay in the home and take care of children. So the idea of this kind of gender complementarity is fundamental to the anti-gender thought of the right wing. And that's really shot through all the rhetoric. And that the Vatican's really big on that. Like men and women are different and, you know, do different things. So that's the rhetoric. But remember that sex has long been the kind of mobile tool of governing, from marriage laws to laws that are organized. If you look into history and the, you know, anti-miscegenation laws, there are many ways they're kind of organized to reproduce white supremacy, to laws surrounding reproductive rights and the criminalization of women's bodies. Anti-gender, the right wing, anti-gender people, anti-transgender people in many states have this rationale for their recent bans on gender-affirming care. And they kind of talk about, well, we know what sex is, we know what a woman is, and people can't just change their sex. But the certitudes, what they're so certain about with that ideology, kind of drops away when it's convenient. Over and over throughout history, through the machinery of enslavement, welfare, social security, labor, tax policy, capital's need for labor has prevailed over abstract commitments to an immutable gender binary. In the colonies and the New American Republic, for instance, despite the prevalence of the language of marriage, family, and the benefits of domesticity, theories of gender difference were not applied to enslaved people. There are no protections for their marriages, which could be sundered at will through the sale of one spouse. In the words of the historian Tara Hunter, the ideology of race trumped the ideology of domesticity. Or consider a couple of more recent examples. The Trump administration was all out against transgender people and had this plan to define sex as beginning at conception, birth, and then conception. And everybody paid a lot of attention to that. But at the same time, he was renegotiating the free trade agreement with Canada and Mexico, North American Free Trade Agreement. And so one part of the Trump administration's domestic policy was like, gender identity doesn't exist. It's not a thing. There's no such thing as discrimination based on gender identity. Yet when he was renegotiating NAFTA, part of NAFTA with Canada and Mexico was like, oh yeah, you also have to have gender identity protections in there. And the Trump administration was like, yeah, sure, fine. You know, they just put it in there. They, you know, maybe they thought it wouldn't matter, but like they cared much more about their NAFTA policy passing than like some pure thought of gender identity. Or another example would be during the height of the COVID pandemic, the federal government expanded the child tax credit, raising the amount of tax credits and making them refundable. No single policy has done so much to alleviate child poverty. Between 3 and 4 million children were lifted out of it. This would seem to be a win for the anti-gender movement, as the policy might enable more families to follow the romantic patriarchal model of a male wage earner and a woman caring for children at home. But in 2002, Senator Joe Manchin and the Republicans let it lapse. And they're talking about bringing it back, but not as refundable as it was. So, and why did they let it lapse? The University of Chicago's Becker Friedman Institute, and for those of us who pay attention to these kind of things, it's like it's perfect that it's named the Becker Friedman Institute because they're like the architects of neoliberal economic theory. The Becker Friedman Institute had done this paper about the making the child tax credit fully refundable and making it larger, and they had warned ominously that the expended credit, by incentivizing parents to stay home, would shrink the labor force and drive up wages. And you see this in the Republicans and Manchin statements about why they don't support the thing. It's like, well, this is terrible for the labor market. So gender roles can be redefined if the economy demands it. So it's likely that these same policymakers would also mandate that everyone carry a driver's license listing their birth sex. And that's not a contradiction, because gender, as we know it, doesn't really beget itself. It's not a cause. It's, in fact, an effect of power. All right, so I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Alex Byrne, and I'm a master's student in the Women and Gender Studies program here. My own area of study is actually on the way that media reports on trans people and queer people in general, and how that affects public opinion of them. And I was wondering what part you think the media plays in getting these political acts enacted.
That's a really good question. I think it kind of depends. There's a, you know, us liberals, lefty, like, we sort of have a love-hate relationship with the New York Times. Like, it's kind of like we want to love it, but we hate it. But we really hate it right now because New York Times coverage is not right wing. It's geared towards their imagined demographic, like the suburban liberal voters whose kids might have come home from middle school, say, call me they. You know what I mean? Like, they're like, who are maybe like, what's going on? So they published these articles that, that center the concerns of parents. And like, that's like an important thing to cover and talk about, but they're so lopsided. They talk about the concerned parents and they talk about, you know, some who right wing groups that are arguing against gender affirming care. And they have had very little coverage of like from the children themselves. They might show up in like paragraph 17 of a 20 paragraph story. So right wing media that doesn't like transgender people, like, that's not a surprise. But it's like the liberal media that like centers these concerns about that's really shifted a lot of the debate, because a lot of people are not, you know, people are basically good, and they just need to be, they don't know what's going on. And so they read about these parents who are flipping out about their children, and they're like, oh my God, that could happen to me. So they're not hearing from parents who are supporting their children as much. So I do think, you know, the media has like a really important role to play in terms of like, I hate to say both sides, but if the Times could even start getting both sides, and you're like getting like more voices of transgender youth and transgender people instead of just the concerned parents. So that gets to your question.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So one of the other things we were talking about and thinking about the wider cultural moment in which this is happening, you know, because you gave us a really detailed and disquieting and fascinating look at the kind of legal frameworks and the legislative language that's being used, is, so one of the things I've been wondering a lot about is COVID-19 and the pandemic and why it is that we see this. Obviously the ground was being laid before the pandemic, but this like dramatic uptick in this anti-trans legislation post-pandemic. And one of the things I've been thinking about a lot is, what is it that this pandemic destabilized in the culture? How did it make the ground so fertile? Or do you see a connection between the pandemic and what happened in the pandemic and the massive destabilization that happened during the pandemic and the way in which the ground is now so fertile for this massive, you know, exponential uptick in anti-trans legislation?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I have some ideas. I mean, I think one of the things, I think the social science of the pandemic, as it's still coming out, is going to be so fascinating. But one of the things the pandemic did is it sort of got rid of the idea that we are separable, you know, that you could be safe, that you could kind of cut yourself off. So the idea that like we are in a community and we are relational. And so maybe there's a way in which the anti-trans stuff, because the right wing is talking about gender and people are born a certain way and it's sex, but like even they understand that gender is relational. Like, why do they make women wear women's clothes? Because the women are supposed to relate who they are through these signs to each other. So maybe that's just like an idea. Maybe there's something about the kind of the relational quality of gender that they want to fix back in place, because, you know, the fact that people can make each other sick just by talking to each other in public spaces is pretty unnerving. But there's so much weird stuff going on, because, you know, the anti-mask movement, you know, which just directly used abortion rights rhetoric, like, keep your laws off my body. That was fascinating. And when I was publicizing the book, the press had me do all these podcasts, and I would just be on whatever podcast. And I was on a podcast with this guy in West Virginia, and he was like, I don't like transgender people. I didn't serve in the military. I don't like transgender people. So I was like, that's fine. But I said, well, yeah, but his name was like Martin or something. He's like, Martin, do you want the government telling you what your gender is? And like, he doesn't like the gender stuff, but he doesn't like the government telling him what to do. So he was briefly on my side, because, you know, from the kind of this kind of libertarian thing, like, no, I do not want the government doing that. But I'm sure if he thought later, he'd probably be fine with it. But so there's lots of different flows about like integrity, the integrity of the body and the integrity of the person. And I do think there's something about COVID that unsettled people so much around that.
This kind of relates to, you brought up the picture of the Pope, and yeah, just making me think, I mean, the anti-gender ideology, at least the critique specifically on like cisgender women's behavior, has been going on for a couple decades, right? And I'm thinking about the kind of transnational flow of this and how, you know, rhetoric from the Vatican and other fundamentalist religious groups around the globe are also kind of operating in this way. So I'm just kind of wondering if you could talk about how you see this picture that you trace here in the U.S. is really being situated in these global networks. And also, explain to me, like, to me, neoliberalism is about making people work. So I'm just kind of curious about these restrictions, right? Like, I mean, you made the point that, you know, they'll do away with these laws, they can get women out working, make us all work when it's convenient, but at other times there's an attempt to restrict and to reinforce these really traditional family roles that really don't support this kind of neoliberal ideology of work, 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 work. So I'm just wondering if you could put, just explain that for me.
Well, yeah, there's a lot going on there. But in terms of the movement against gender ideology, which started in the 1980s with Cardinal Ratzinger when he was a cardinal in Berlin, and then he became a pope, but he noticed that trans people in Germany were changing some documents. He was like, what's that? And then they discovered gender studies, and they're like, somebody brought like a gender studies syllabus to the Vatican, and they're like, what is this? And suddenly, and at the same time, in 1995, the UN meeting in Beijing with a platform for women used the word gender. And they right-wing folks weren't really paying attention. They're like, wait, gender? Why did they just use the word sex? Well, gender refers to social roles, which are different. And suddenly, the American right wing and the Vatican was all over that. Like, gender is like a bad word to use because it suggests like there's some distinction from sex. So all this gets incorporated into this kind of anti-gender thought, which suggests that there's this gender ideology that is just saying there's no difference between men and women, and which allows transsexual people to exist. But it did not, it circulated in the right wing, even in the United States, but right-wing folks in the United States didn't use the word gender ideology until very recently. Because ideology is like a big word, gender is a big word. But Ron DeSantis started using it in Florida, other people started talking about woke gender ideology. So now it was already kind of, they're already kind of layered together in terms of communication, but now there's more more direct invocation of the idea of gender ideology. But internationally, in some countries, gender ideology is described as totalitarian. So places that used to be totalitarian, they're like, oh, gender ideology is totalitarian. And other countries are like, gender ideology is about the excesses of capitalism. So this kind of what Judith Butler in their new book calls this phantasmic construction around gender, it changes shape depending on what the usual enemies are. In terms of neoliberalism, I guess we now have to call it like liberal neoliberalism or left neoliberalism, which is like everybody is fungible. Everybody just goes to work, and it doesn't. Gender is this kind of old-fashioned artifact of pre-modern times that we don't really need to pay attention to. But the return of traditional values and a certain kind of bringing back like naturalized hierarchies, I think is like a turn that we see with like the right-wing turn with the Trump administration in 2016. And so one way to think about it, there's lots, some of you I'm sure have even better ideas, but one way to think of it is like hierarchy gives people something to hang on to, right? So the worker is totally alienated, doesn't make enough money, but he comes home and there's a natural gender hierarchy in his house. So at least that's kind of an important way to look at it. Because a lot of people who write about conservatives say like one of the fundamental things, this is political theorist Corey Robbins' idea, one of the fundamental aspects of conservatism is its relationship to hierarchy. And it's not just in society, but it's like personal ascribed of status. So that it could be a way to kind of bring that back in. But I think we're still kind of sorting through like how neoliberal thought could turn so quickly and from kind of a representative neoliberal diversity that everybody could work to a more traditional one. But the folks who write about that and pay attention to all the different schools of thought and German thinkers and ordo liberals, they kind of suggest that there was always a traditional values hierarchy in neoliberalism, but it's just now it's kind of coming to the fore. But it doesn't exactly answer your question of like how that shift happened. Who knows? Yeah.
Thank you for being here. I'm Theo. I'm a humanities PhD student here looking into trans studies and things like that. I read your book, the one from 22, and I was really interested in the way that you're talking about like intelligibility and legibility. And you talk about how we are now at a moment of like heightened legibility in popular culture, trans people in popular culture, and the way that we're being talked about. And I wondered, how do we like reconcile that transness and things like that? We're at a heightened moment in history where we are very intelligible, but the people reading us don't have the correct like literacy skills. Like they don't know how to translate our bodies kind of correctly in the way that they are trying to read us to define laws or these kind of categories that seem filled with bankrupt linguistic terms and things like that. That's as coherent as I could get this question.
It's so interesting because it's like the normal story of civil rights is like a community becomes known to itself, and then it has this kind of identity and it messaging, and it kind of becomes known to other people. And there's like transgender people, and there's all this education, and this is what we do. This is the different ways of being transgender. But that story kind of takes a turn with the kind of right-wing turn where legibility or even visibility becomes actually not a plus, but a point of vulnerability. So the visibility of transgender people has actually now made people much more vulnerable. Because I think in terms of reading people, what we call them, transphobic people or whatever, I think they can read transgender people perfectly well. They just are, they're just kind of making a decision about like how to treat them. It used to be that in the legal discourse, even conservative judges for a long time would use the right pronouns in the cases. Even if they're just saying like this person is not protected from sex discrimination, they would kind of use the pronoun that the person would want to use. So it was this interesting kind of like decorum, and now it seems like that has kind of the level of anti-trans vitriol against transgender people is so heightened. It seems like that has really changed. Jules Gill Peterson has a new book called A Short History of Trans Misogyny, and she talks in that book a lot about the dangers of visibility and how visibility has, the costs are borne differently. So the costs of visibility are borne more by trans women and more by trans women of color, even as they're sort of tokenized or thrown out there. It's like, oh, we care about trans women of color, but it creates these situations of vulnerability and danger. So there's so much interesting in terms of like legibility and that sort of stuff. Like where I grew up in a small farming community in Southern Ontario. It's like those women look trans. Those farming women, like their house dress and their big muscles and unshaven and everything. Like they if you put them now in like a queer bar, they'd be like, maybe the house dress would look a bit odd, but they would come off as pretty non-gender non-conforming. But in that particular place, they were like, that was just what you look like. So it's all, and so there's like, it really depends on context too.
So this is sort of a weird question, but I was thinking about you talking about the language being used to define sex and like the focus on like our reproductive anatomy, and specifically like the sexual undertones of being like, and sperm exists to penetrate an ovum and that kind of language. And I kind of am connecting it with the rhetoric around like trans men being women who are getting rid of their breast and like becoming less sexually viable to people. Just do you have any insight about like the underlying like sexual tones? Like, of course, like there's always a tendency to turn what transness is into some kind of perversion. Do you think that reflects anything in the way that right-wing people like view trans people?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of different overlapping like kind of rhetorics or discourses. Like the idea that trans people are groomers, it doesn't even make sense even if you just are transphobic, right? Like it's just like the gay idea that gay people are groomers is terrible. It's not true. But there's a logic to it that works in the sense that gayness is about sexual identity or sexuality, and it doesn't even work with trans. But the lack of logic doesn't really even seem to matter. But I think there's something else going on about, there's so much concern about transmasculine people, and especially transmasculine youth. And if you look at all the New York Times stories, they're often transmasculine youth, and they're often usually white. So there's a certain kind of like anxiety about white people like exiting this gender reproductive system in terms of like reproduction of race or reproduction of social norms. So I think there's a lot of anxiety about that. Like people are saying, no to gender. Like my kid and half her class, they went through this phase of all saying they were all they for a couple of years. Like she was non-binary, and then I got her a non-binary flag. but then it was the wrong flag because she was actually gender fluid and all her friends were doing that. And their teachers are supposed to ask every day what pronoun they wanted to use. It's like, you can't do that to your teacher. And it was like, just like, the right wing would describe her as a detransitioner because she had a pronoun and then she didn't. But it's just kind of like, also like experimenting is like, I don't think I like being a girl walking down the street being harassed on the way to the bus. Like, I think I'm going to say they. And it's like, so like a little bit of exiting from the gender, you know, the gender system. I was talking to a reporter the other day from the Times, and she might write a column with this, but like, remember the old compulsory heterosexuality of Adrienne Rich? So it's a little bit like, maybe just kind of a little bit of an exit of the compulsory gender system. And that creates some anxiety. And Professor or Dr. Story was so funny this morning. Those of you who are there, she was talking about these larger currents where like white women were just saying to men. They're like, no, I don't care. We're not going to get married. I'm not going to, you know, have your babies and do your dishes. And that's creating all this kind of anxiety too. So I think there are these larger currents around people kind of like exiting or stepping outside of or saying no to a lot of the different gender norms. And that's why there's this concern about like, when we have to define women in terms of their reproductive capacity. Because men are defined in terms of their reproductive capacity, but it's women who are going to bear the burden of that. And it seems to be like a way to kind of try to rein in people who might say, no, I don't think I want to do that.
Thank you.
And that is how the conversation wrapped up back on March 7th at the University of Louisville's Planetarium with the 2024 Minx Auerbach Lecture in Women's and Gender Studies, featuring our wonderful guest speaker, author of Sex Is As Sex Does, Governing Transgender Identity. His name is Paisley Curran, and he's a professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Political Science at the City University of New York. Hope you enjoyed that important community conversation about legislating gender. That's the kind of stuff you'll get here each week on Truth to Power. So we'll see you all again next week on Forward Radio.